Radio.
John Milbank on Sexual Difference and the Ontology of Peace. A presentation by Dr. Brendan Triffitt at the Christopher Dawson Center for Cultural Studies 2016 Colloquium.
So the way that this paper started to develop while I was writing it, it looks like it's going to be a bit of a triptych with three parts which will complement each other. But I probably will only have time for the two parts. So see this is not as a complete argument that stands on its own, but more of an invitation to thinking. In the Gospel of John, Jesus says, "I have come that they may have life and have it to the full." One may ask, what does the fullness of life look like? What form must one's life take if it is to be an abundant life? Christians will, of course, look to the life of Jesus for the answer. But in order to bring out an important contrast, and because I'm a philosopher, I'm going to turn first to an influential German philosopher of the late 19th century. For Friedrich Nietzsche, abundant life is the will to power expressed in all its fullness. What do I mean by the will to power? He means by that the force of life asserting its presence and flowing over into expression and self-expansion. The will to power is an essentially blind and reckless vital force that rises up and exerts itself in the world. The will to power stirs in the depths of each of us, but actually in some types of people it's more strong than others. Nietzsche was a racist on this point. So Nietzsche recommends that we release this vital power into full expression. In order to be true to our nature, we must leave behind all ethical principles, conventional ethical principles and social conventions, since these repress the raw potentialities inherent in nature. We must do away with the constraining norms of truth, goodness and beauty. So Nietzsche's not a fan of truth, goodness or beauty. These are human constructs by which we sap away the life of nature. We have to get rid of these constraining norms and celebrate the raw dynamism of life, the dark and formless will to power. We are to let nature express itself as it would, unconstrained by form, logos, or convention. The calculating, reasonable ego must give way to the unpredictable and irrational movements of life itself. Fundamentally, life is nothing but sheer power. It's essentially irrational, heartless, formless, meaningless. Just as an aside, this fits very easily with a Darwinian view of life. I make that point because it's hard to see how a Darwinian view of the cosmos can provide a ground for a compassionate ethos. But coming back to my paper. So Nietzsche recommends that we affirm existence in all its nihilistic brutality. The Übermensch, the supermen, who live life beyond good and evil, so to put aside the distinction between good and evil, there's no such thing, will enjoy life without measure. So this is a play on words, without measure. So just pay attention to how I'm using these words. By that he means first that life is ultimately chaotic, formless, meaningless. And second, that living an abundant life means not pretending that life has any organizing form or high meaning or final purpose. Life simply is. The will to power simply exerts itself as it does. Since there's no higher purpose, it's more honest if we simply give ourselves over to the sheer play of natural forces, the stark and brutal expression of will to power. Let me give two illustrations of this idea played out in culture today. In Homeric times, the times talked about in the poems of Homer, we have a very brutal view of life. This is before the classical Greece. And we see that view of life expressed in the popular television series Game of Thrones. It's all about power, the struggle for power. There's no ultimate purpose. When Plato comes along, he changes this because he has an idea that there is a transcendent good and transcendent ideals that things need to participate in. Another example, each year at Dark Mofo, The Hobart Council joins with Nietzsche, at least to a degree, in commending a nihilistic celebration of chaos. A Dionysian descent into the dark and irrational. So Dionysius is also Bacchus. So he's the god associated with revelry, drunkenness, orgies and so forth. So obviously the Christian view of abundant life is quite different. According to this worldview, the fullness of life is the divine life lived in the Trinity. This is what life is when it's lived to the absolute maximum. Life is not meaningless because it's intrinsically oriented toward a loving communion of persons. Life is not irrational, not sheer irrational play of force, since it includes the divine logos, the word. Life is not formless, for the absolute expression of life is the infinite harmony and perfect order of the Trinity. Now, I'm quite influenced by this Orthodox theologian called David Bentley Hart, and he points out that the metaphysics that Christianity introduces is a very important break from the Greek view, because the Greeks believed that the infinite, the absolute, was formless chaos. But Christianity comes along and says, no, the maximum expression of a reality and being is form, perfect order. So for Christianity, divine being occurs as Trinity, and the Trinity's perfect harmony, order, meaning, and love. God is truth, goodness, and beauty. So hopefully I've given you a bit of a contrast between two worldviews. So I've given you two cosmologies, two views of what the universe looks like as a whole and what being is fundamentally. And from this comes different views of how we should live our life. Recall Nietzsche opposes the fullness of life to the constraining measure of form. In order to be truly fulfilled or self-expressive or honest to who we are, for Nietzsche means we need to do away with convention, form. These all constrain the brutal nihilistic forces of life in us. But as the contemporary Anglo-Catholic theologian John Milbank explains, the Christian understanding of life does not oppose life to form at all. In fact, they think life and form together. Another way of putting that is happiness, true happiness, has a particular shape, and that shape is given to us in the life of Jesus and also in the form of the Trinity. On the Christian view, says Milbank, there's no such thing as sheer life without direction, sheer will to power without form. On the contrary, there are certain ontological norms that things have to abide by in order to have life at all. There are universal laws of being, and beings must participate in these laws in order to have being. A being has life and power to the extent that it is measured, regulated, formed by unity and truth, goodness and beauty. Putting it in quite a pithy way, God himself is life without limit, but not life without measure. So infinite life is not limited, and yet there is a certain form or order that measures that life. Having said that, when Milbank talks about these sorts of things, he always points out that from our point of view, in a sense, God is formless, because any form that we try and conceive of, God himself exceeds that, and we cannot contain it within our concepts. So in a sense, God is formless, but that's only an epistemological point. It's not an ontological point. I'm getting toward the end of the first section. I began this section by asking what the fullness of life looks like. What form must one's life take if it is to be an abundant life? The Christian answer is that an abundant life will necessarily take a Trinitarian form. I realize that's a little bit pie in the sky, and it has to be applied and cashed out a bit more, but I'm not going to have time for that. There could be no such thing as an abundant life without truth, goodness, and beauty. So it says Nietzsche's wrong, because if you want to have an abundant life, a full life that is in accordance with how reality is, you have to embody truth and goodness and beauty in your life. A full release of the power of being. So this is an understanding that reality at the deepest level has a power. It wants to express itself, but in order to really let that power of being or the deeper magic come through in your life, you've got to express it as love, as communion. An amoral display of sheer power is not a more generous expression of life, as Nietzsche thought, but actually that's a diminishing of life. Remember, on Nietzsche's view, the full plenitude of life is life without measure, beyond form, beyond meaning and order. But on the Christian view, the full plenitude of life is life found in form. So here Milbank says that he's influenced by Augustine, because Augustine says violence and chaos does not have a foothold in the deep structure of reality. For Augustine, evil is not actually one principle of being alongside the good. This was a Gnostic idea that then came through in Manichaeism, that there was an ultimate good principle and an ultimate evil principle, and they sort of fought it out. But Augustine says, no, reality, being, is goodness. And to the extent that something exists, it is good. This was his answer to the Gnostics who would say that material creation was evil. So violence, evil, chaos are accidental intrusions into reality. It didn't have to be this way. There didn't have to be violence in our world. This is a result of the fall, which didn't have to happen. It's not part of the deep order of things. It's our circumstance that we're in. So this understanding of being is what Milbank calls the ontology of peace. Ontology of peace says that being has a certain transcendental form, and that takes the form of harmonization between different things. And he finds that in Augustine's view of the Trinity as well. So now I'm going to attempt to demonstrate how Milbank's ontology of peace can shed light on marriage and the difference between the sexes. So we moderns tend to imagine, I think we all have a metaphysics, really, an understanding of what reality looks like. We don't often reflect on it, but I think we do all have one. We moderns tend to imagine that each individual thing and each individual person simply expresses its own individual force, its own individual life. But according to Milbank, this view of things reads violence into the heart of reality. Suppose that the deepest inclination of every individual is simply to exert itself in the world, to express its own will to power. In that case, there's no possibility of genuine harmony between things or of genuine peace. Each individual being must struggle against other individual beings. Individuals must fight over the same space to exist. This is what I do in the rest of this section. I reflect on space. So the Nietzschean view of reality, which is also the Darwinian one and the Marxist one, they think of space as being competitive space. There are different parties. You might say there's different identity groups, or there's different creatures, or there's different people who both are claiming the same space all the same time, you might say. The same attention, the same power, the same structures. Either one has it or the other. The gain for one is a loss for another. At the social level, this conflictual dynamic is typically played out in collective terms. To the extent that one identity group, say the women's movement, wins the right to express itself more fully in a certain arena, the opposing group, in this case, the sum of all men, loses that right. Marxist theories read culture and history in these conflictual terms. So, at this point, I'm developing Milbank's ideas. I'm not reading from his work so much as developing his idea in my own way. Inspired by Milbank, I would say that what underlies this Marxist conflictual view of reality is the notion of an unshareable space. Now, I'm using the word space in a broad, analogous sense, not just the literal physical sense. So, I mean, we do use the word space. We talk about interpersonal spaces, political spaces, social spaces. Okay, here's one example of what this unshareable space looks like. Either we women are able to be here to speak and express ourselves in this space, or you men are able to be here to speak and express yourselves in this space, but it's impossible for both our identity group and your identity group to enjoy the same space at the same time. And now we declare that your allotted time in this unshareable space is up. It's our time now, thank you very much. Now, what I want to explore is an alternative view. which amounts to the ontology of peace. And that's to understand that spaces are shareable. And I think we need to think of spaces in this way to really think how God has designed his creation. So it's going to be a non-Darwinian, non-Marxist, non-Nietzschean view. It's going to be a Christian view. So let's return to the first chapters of Genesis, which unsurprisingly has come up a few times. I'm going to show that actually, well, I hope to show, that if you read Genesis in a particular way, it doesn't actually advocate subordination of women at all. Because what Genesis is about is the sharing of the same space. I actually believe that this is to be taken literally. I'm with the Calvinists on this one, and the old-fashioned Catholics. But my argument is not actually dependent on that, okay? So you read this as a narrative of a key for interpreting reality rather than necessarily a historical fact. So Adam and Eve lived in the very same Garden of Eden, didn't they? They shared the same perfect place of dwelling. Now, that doesn't mean that there was Adam's territory over here and Eve's territory over there, did it? There was equal sharing without competition and without division. So I'm going to look through those three points, three parts of that idea. In the first place, there was equal sharing. Adam and Eve were given equal dignity as human beings, equal dominion over creation. Dominion here needs to be thought in terms of stewardship. Equal freedom to enjoy all the non-forbidden fruits of the garden, equal right to enjoy the whole of their common paradise. Second, there was no competition. The vocation of Adam, so whatever he was called to do, whatever he was called to be, and the vocation of Eve were certainly different. Before the fall, the role that Adam played in the created order did not compete with the role that Eve played in the created order. They couldn't have if this was paradise. So it wasn't as if Adam and Eve found themselves competing over the same resources or over the same position or status. Adam's dominion as a man and Eve's dominion as a woman, and I'm talking about dominion over creation, not each other, these dominions were not in conflict. They did not even have to compromise. So I'm going to take this a little bit further and say they didn't even compromise. Because in our current state in the world, compromise is often good and necessary, but I don't think there was even compromise, because compromise only arises where the needs and wants of one come into conflict with the needs and wants of the other, and you come to an agreement of how you're going to negotiate that difficult situation. But before the fall, I would argue that was never the case. The trajectory of Adam's vocation and his desires and the trajectory of Eve's vocation and desires were perfectly harmonized, complementary. It was not as if Eve had to say, okay, Adam, Mondays, Tuesdays, Wednesdays and half of Thursdays, they'll be your days. On those days, whenever your happiness comes into conflict with my happiness, or whenever your role in the garden comes into conflict with my role, then I'll give way to you. All of the other times, you give way to me. This is how contemporary society negotiates conflicts today. And I mean, it's fair enough. But that's not the original design of things. Eve didn't have to say this either. Okay, Adam, how about you have that half of the garden, I'll have this half of the garden. You can have all that space to yourself, have your little man cave. You can be completely happy and fulfilled that way because your needs and wants won't conflict with mine. That can be your individual domain for your flourishing, and this will be my individual domain for my flourishing. And by the way, I suggest we split the garden just here so I get this particular tree. My point is that the sharing of space that I've been talking about is not like this. It's not a division of space. It's not the common use of the same space at different times. Like, for example, this space would be used for different purposes at different times. Sharing space, in my sense, is rather this: living fully in the same space at the same time in such a way that one person's living in that space is actually enhanced by the other person's living in that same space. What this means, if we return to the creation story, is that Adam is given his freedom to live in the garden fully, only at the point of Eve's creation. Before that point, his dwelling in the garden is existentially incomplete. He's lonely, he's in need of a companion. So Eve doesn't arrive in Adam's world as a threat. Quite the opposite. With the creation of Eve, he's not robbed of his free reign. He's not diminished in his capacity to enjoy his world. Actually, the opposite. Adam's dominion in the garden only really starts once he rules there with Eve. His kingship, if you like, is incomplete without Eve's queenship. We can make the same point in terms of meaning. Perhaps Adam was able to name the animals without Eve beside him. I don't know. But even so, there was a sense in which the world he inhabited lacked meaning before Eve arrived on the scene. We all intuitively grasp this point. A world that is not shared with another is a world that lacks meaning. The world is only really given to us as intelligible once it's given to two of us at once. "I wish you were here" is what one lover writes to another when visiting some new place as a tourist. Let me summarize the points I've just made. The Garden of Eden is God's gift to Adam. The same garden is also God's gift to Eve, the whole of it, in both cases. But to say that the garden is also God's gift for Eve is not to say that it's a gift for Eve in some lesser qualified sense. Nor is the garden split into two separate domains, one for Adam, the other for Eve. The same garden in its entirety, the same domain, is given for the enjoyment of both. We can go even further here. Adam's enjoyment of the garden and Eve's enjoyment of the garden are inseparable. Like acts of marital intimacy, enjoyment by one, you just can't separate it from the enjoyment of the other. By nature, the enjoyment has to be together. Further, the same garden in its entirety is given for the freedom and dominion of both. Adam's dominion over material creation and Eve's dominion over material creation are inseparable. In short, what I'm saying, if I want to put it into a pithy statement, Adam and Eve inhabited the very same space, but in different and complementary ways. I'm just going to ad lib a little bit here. My approach to this problem of sexual difference and the issue of same-sex marriage just by temperament is to start thinking about the deep structure of reality. Benno talked about deeper magic. Yes. Yes. And Shimon Cohen talked about the Kabbalah, which is a mystical, mythical way of thinking about deeper structures of reality. And this is exactly what I'm doing here. I'm trying to find... can we find in Genesis or in theology or in Catholic tradition a reading of how reality works, the deep logic of creation? And what I've come up with is this idea of shared space. And what I'm suggesting is that what we have in the Garden of Eden, and this is a clue to how we should live our life today and order our society, although we can't go back to the garden, we should still take the same norms that are expressed in that Genesis myth, we should think about the fact that God has created man and woman in such a way that they inhabit the same space in a different way. Let's make this more concrete. Jennifer Ryback Morse makes this really, really poignant point. She's noticed that, there's breakdowns in marriages everywhere. But she says that there's an inherent instability in lesbian relationships as soon as one of them becomes the mother. And this is because a mother, by nature, wants to be the mother of the child. And it's not natural for the mother to share that motherhood with another woman. What that couple is trying to do is inhabit the same space in the same way. And really, that's my proposal, is that, this is not an argument that I can really take to its full conclusion, but it's a suggestion that if we can think about same-sex marriage as proposing as a social structure, two people inhabiting the same space, which is the family life, in the same way, in a way that we can't work. And I think the way that it can't work is either the two males or the two females are vying over the same role, or they have to shift roles so that one becomes more feminine, one more masculine, in order to negotiate that space. Thank you. Thank you.
That was Dr. Brendan Triffitt with John Milbank on sexual difference and the ontology of peace. This presentation was part of the Christopher Dawson Center for Cultural Studies 2016 colloquium on the theme, The Nature of Men and Women, Complementary but Different, which was hosted in Hobart, Australia. For more talks, interviews and shows, visit cradio.org.au.